"What happened to them?" he asked, his face troubled. "To Gavin's wife and his son?"
Jamie's eyes met mine, and his hand touched my thigh. I knew, without being told, what had happened to the Hayes family. Without Jamie's own courage and intransigence, the same thing would likely have happened to me, and to our daughter, Brianna.
"Gavin never knew," Jamie said quietly. "He never heard aught of his wife. She will have been starved, maybe, or driven out to die of the cold. His son took the field beside him at Culloden. Whenever a man who had fought there came into our cell, Gavin would ask, 'Have you maybe seen a bold lad named Archie Hayes about so tall?'"
He measured automatically, 5 feet from the floor, capturing Hayes's gesture.
"A lad about 14, he'd say, with a green plaidie and a small gilt brooch. But no one ever came who had seen him for sure. Either seen him fall or seen him run away safe."
Jamie took a sip of the ale, his eyes fixed on a pair of British officers who had come in and settled in the corner. It had grown dark outside, and they were plainly off duty. Their leather stocks were unfastened on account of the heat, and they wore only sidearms, glinting under their coats, nearly black in the dim light, save where the firelight touched them with red.
"Sometimes he hoped the lad might have been captured and transported," he said, "like his brother."
"Surely that would be somewhere in the records," I said. "Did they, do they, keep lists?"
"They did," Jamie said, still watching the soldiers.
A small, bitter smile touched the corner of his mouth.
"It was such a list that saved me after Culloden, when they asked my name before shooting me, so as to add it to their roll. But a man like Gavin would have no way to see the English dead lists. And if he could have found out, I think he would not."
He glanced at me.
"Would you choose to know for sure, and it was your child?"
I shook my head, and he gave me a faint smile and squeezed my hand. Our child was safe, after all. He picked up his cup and drained it, then beckoned to the serving maid. The girl brought the food, skirting the table widely in order to avoid Rollo. The beast lay motionless under the table, his head protruding into the room, and his great hairy tail lying heavily across my feet. But his yellow eyes were wide open, watching everything. They followed the girl intently, and she backed nervously away, keeping an eye on him until she was safely out of biting distance. Seeing this, Jamie cast a dubious look at the so-called dog.
"Is he hungry? Must I ask for a fish for him?"
"Oh, no, uncle," Ian reassured him. "Rollo catches his own fish."
Jamie's eyebrows shot up, but he only nodded, and with a wary glance at Rollo, took a platter of roasted oysters from the tray.
"Ah, the pity of it."
Innes was quite drunk by now. He sat slumped against the wall, his armless shoulder riding higher than the other, giving him a strange, hunchbacked appearance.
"That a dear man like Gavin should come to such an end."
He shook his head lugubriously, swinging it back and forth over his ale cup, like the clapper of a funeral bell.
"No family left to mourn him, cast alone into a savage land, hanged as a felon, and to be buried in an unconsecrated grave. Not even a proper lament to be sung for him."
He picked up the cup, and with some difficulty found his mouth with it. He drank deep, and set it down with a muffled clang.
"Well, he shall have a carish."
He glared belligerently from Jamie to Fergus to Ian.
"Why not?"
Jamie wasn't drunk, but he wasn't completely sober, either. He grinned at Duncan, and lifted his own cup in salute.
"Why not, indeed," he said. "Only it will have to be you singing it, Duncan. None of the rest knew Gavin, and I'm no singer. I'll shout along with you, though."
Duncan nodded magisterially, bloodshot eyes surveying us. Without warning, he flung back his head and emitted a terrible howl. I jumped in my seat, spilling half a cup of ale into my lap. Ian and Fergus, who had evidently heard Gaelic laments before, didn't turn a hair.
All over the room, benches were shoved back as men leapt to their feet in alarm, reaching for their pistols. The barmaid leaned out of the serving hatch, eyes big. Rollo came awake with an explosive woof and glared round wildly, teeth bared.
"Hashin chayn achoy acharej, Gavin Hayes,"
Duncan thundered in a ragged baritone. I had just about enough Gaelic to translate this as, "We are met to weep and cry out to heaven for the loss of our friend, Gavin Hayes."
"Eisrich,"
Jamie chimed in. He was born of Seamus Emmanuel Hayes and of Louisa McClellan in the village of Kilmartin in the parish of Dundanil in the year of our Lord 1701.
"Eisrich."
This time Fergus and Ian joined in on the chorus, which I translated roughly as, "Hear him." Rollo appeared not to care for either verse or refrain. His ears lay flat against his skull, and his yellow eyes narrowed to slits. Ian scratched his head in reassurance, and he lay down again, muttering wolf curses under his breath. The audience, having caught on to it that no actual violence threatened, and no doubt bored with the inferior vocal efforts of the drinking society in the corner, settled down to enjoy the show. By the time Duncan had worked his way into an accounting of the names of the sheep Gavin Hayes had owned before leaving his croft to follow his laird to Culloden, many of those at the surrounding tables were joining enthusiastically in the chorus, shouting, "Eirishdish!" and banging their mugs on the tables in perfect ignorance of what was being said. And a good thing, too. Duncan, drunker than ever, fixed the soldiers at the next table with a baleful glare, sweat pouring down his face.
"Ahasrich nagalach! Solke fika fanige ba gashka! Hin leis an chavanchi! Dirach do ifin! Wicked Sassenach dogs, eaters of dead flesh. Ill does it become you to laugh and rejoice at the death of a gallant man. May the devil himself seize upon you in the hour of your death and take you straight to hell."
Ian blanched slightly at this, and Jamie cast Duncan a narrow look, but they stoutly shouted,
"Eisrich,"
along with the rest of the crowd.
Fergus, seized by inspiration, got up and passed his hat among the crowd, who, carried away by ale and excitement, happily flung coppers into it for the privilege of joining in their own denunciation. I had as good a head for drink as most men, but a much smaller bladder. Head spinning from the noise and fumes as much as from alcohol, I got up and edged my way out from behind the table, through the mob, and into the fresh air of the early evening. It was still hot and sultry, though the sun was long since down. Still, there was a lot more air out here, and a lot fewer people sharing it. Having relieved the internal pressure, I sat down on the tavern's chopping block with my pewter mug, breathing deeply. The night was clear, with a bright half-moon peeping silver over the harbour's edge. Our wagon stood nearby, no more than its outline visible in the light from the tavern windows. Presumably, Gavin Hayes's decently shrouded body lay within. I trusted he had enjoyed his harish. Inside, Duncan's chanting had come to an end. A clear tenor voice, wobbly with drink, but sweet nonetheless, was singing a familiar tune, audible over the babble of talk.
"To Anacreon in heaven, where he sat in full glee, a few sons of harmony sent a petition that he their inspirer and patron would be. When this answer arrived from the jolly old Grecian, voice, fiddle, and flute no longer be mute. I lend you my name and inspire you to boot."
The singer's voice cracked painfully on voice, fiddle, and flute, but he sang stoutly on, despite the laughter from his audience. I smiled wryly to myself as he hit the final couplet.
And besides, I'll instruct you like me to entwine the myrtle of Venus with Bacchus's vine.
I lifted my cup in salute to the wheeled coffin, softly echoing the melody of the singer's last lines.
Oh, say does that star-spangled banner yet wave o'er the land of the free and the home of the brave?
I drained my cup and sat still, waiting for the men to come out. Chapter 2, In Which We Meet a Ghost.
10, 11, 12, and 2, and 6. £1, 8 shillings, 6 pence, 2 farthings.
Fergus dropped the last coin ceremoniously into the cloth pocket, pulled tight the drawstrings, and handed it to Jamie.
And 3 buttons, he added, but I've kept those.
And patted the side of his coat.
You've settled with the landlord for our meal?
Jamie asked me, weighing the little bag.
Yes, I assured him. I have 4 shillings and 6 pence left, plus what Fergus collected.
Fergus smiled modestly, square white teeth gleaming in the faint light from the tavern's window.
We have the necessary money for the burial, then, he said. Will we take Monsieur Hayes to the priest now, or wait until morning?
Jamie frowned at the wagon, standing silent at the edge of the inn yard.
I shouldn't think the priest will be awake at this hour, he said with a glance at the rising moon. Still,
I'd just as soon not take him with us, I said. Not to be rude, I added apologetically to the wagon. But if we're going to sleep out in the woods, the, scent...
It wasn't overpowering, but once away from the smoky reek of the tavern, a distinct odour was noticeable in the vicinity of the wagon. It hadn't been a gentle death, and it had been a hot day.
"Auntie Claire is right,"
Ian said, brushing his knuckles inconspicuously under his nose.
"We dunno want to be attracting wild animals." "We cannot be leaving Gavin here, surely," Duncan protested, scandalized at the thought. "Well, leave him lying on the step of the inn in his shroud, like a foundling wrapped in swaddling clothes."
He swayed alarmingly, his alcoholic intake affecting his always precarious balance. I saw Jamie's wide mouth twitch with amusement, the moon shining white on the knife-edged bridge of his nose.
No, he said, we will not be leaving him here.
He tossed the little bag from hand to hand with a faint chinking sound, then, making his decision, thrust it into his coat.
We'll bury him ourselves, he said. Fergus, will you be stepping into the stable yonder, and see can you buy a speed very cheap?
The short journey to the church through the quiet streets of Charleston was somewhat less dignified than the usual funeral cortege, marked as it was by Duncan's insistence on repeating the more interesting portions of his lament as a processional. Jamie drove slowly, shouting occasional encouragement to the horses. Duncan staggered beside the team, chanting hoarsely and clutching one animal by its headstall, while Ian held the other to prevent bolting. Fergus and I brought up the rear in staid respectability, Fergus holding his newly purchased shovel at port arms and muttering dire predictions as to the likelihood of us all spending the night in jail for disturbing the peace of Charleston. As it was, the church stood by itself in a quiet street, some distance from the nearest house. This was all to the good, in terms of avoiding notice, but it did mean that the churchyard was dauntingly dark, with no glow of torch or candle to pierce the blackness. Great magnolia trees overhung the gate, leathery leaves drooping in the heat, and a border of pines, meant to provide shade and respite in the day, served at night to block all traces of moon and starlight, leaving the churchyard itself black as a, well, as a crypt. Walking through the air felt like pushing aside curtains of black velvet,
perfumed with an incense of turpentine from the sun-heated pines, endless layers of soft, pungent smothering. Nothing could have been farther from the cold purity of the highlands and this stifling southern atmosphere. Still, faint patches of mist hung under the dark brick walls, and I could have wished not to recall Jamie's story of the Tanos quite so vividly.
"We'll find a place. Do you stay and hold the horses, Duncan?"
Jamie slid down from the wagon seat and took me by the arm.
"We'll find a nice wee spot by the wall, perhaps," he said, guiding me toward the gate. "Ian and I will dig while you hold the light, and Fergus can stand guard."
"What about Duncan?" I asked with a backward glance. "Will he be all right?" The Scotsman was invisible, his tall, lanky form having faded into the larger blot comprising horses and wagons, but he was still clearly audible.
"He'll be chief mourner," Jamie said, with a hint of a smile in his voice. "Mind your head, Sassenach."
I ducked automatically beneath a low magnolia branch. I didn't know whether Jamie could actually see in total darkness, or merely felt things by instinct, but I'd never seen him stumble, no matter how dark the surroundings. "Don't you think someone's going to notice a fresh grave?" It wasn't completely black in the churchyard, after all. Once out from under the magnolias, I could make out the dim forms of gravestones, looking insubstantial but sinister in the dark, a faint mist rising from the thick grass about their feet. The soles of my own feet tingled as we picked a ginger way through the stones. I seemed to feel silent waves of reproach at this unseemly intrusion wafting up from below. I barked my shin on a tombstone and bit my lip, stifling an urge to apologize to its owner.
"I expect they might."
Jamie let go of my arm to rummage in his coat.
"But if the priest wanted money to bury Gavin, I shouldn't think he'd trouble to dig him up again for nothing, eh?"
Young Ian materialized out of the darkness at my elbow, startling me.
"There's open space by the north wall, Uncle Jamie," he said, speaking softly, in spite of the obvious fact that there was no one to hear.
He paused and drew slightly closer to me.
"It's very dark in here, no?"
The boy sounded uneasy. He had had nearly as much to drink as Jamie or Fergus, but while the alcohol had imbued the older men with grim humour, it had clearly had a more depressing effect on Ian's spirits.
"It is, aye. I've the bit of a candle I took from the tavern, though. Wait a bit."
Faint rustlings announced Jamie's search for flint and tinderbox. The encompassing dark made me feel disembodied, like a ghost myself. I looked upward and saw stars, so faintly visible through the thick air that they shed no light upon the ground, but only gave a feeling of immense distance and infinite remoteness.
"It's like the vigil of Easter."
Jamie's voice came softly, accompanied by the small scratching sounds of a striking flint.
"I saw the service once at the Notre Dame in Paris. Watch yourself, Ian. There's a stone just there."
A thud and a stifled grunt announced that Ian had belatedly discovered the stone for himself.
"The church was all dark," Jamie continued, "but the folk coming for the service would buy small tapers from the crones at the door. It was something like this."
I felt, rather than saw, his motion at the sky above.
"A great space above, all ringing with the silence, and folk packed in on every side."
Hot as it was, I gave an involuntary shiver at these words, which conjured up a vision of the dead around us, crowding silently side by side, in anticipation of an imminent resurrection.
"And then, just when I thought I couldna bear the silence and the crowd, there came the priest's voice from the door. 'Lumen Christi,' he called out, and the acolytes lit the great candle that he carried. Then from it they took the flame to their own tapers, and scampered up and down the aisles, passing the fire to the candles of the faithful."
I could see his hands, lit faintly by the tiny sparks from his flint.
Then the church came alive with 1,000 small flames. But it was that first candle that broke the dark.
The scratching sounds ceased, and he took away the cupped hand that had shielded the newborn flame. The flame strengthened and lit his face from below, gilding the planes of high cheekbones and forehead, and shadowing the deep-set orbits of his eyes. He lifted the candle, surveying the looming grave markers, eerie as a circle of standing stones.
"Lumen Christi," he said softly, inclining his head toward a granite pillar surmounted with a cross. "Et requiescat in pace, amici."
The half-mocking note had left his voice. He spoke with complete seriousness, and I felt at once oddly comforted, as though some watchful presence had withdrawn. He smiled at me then, and handed me the candle.
"See, can you find a bit of wood for a torch, Sassenach?" he said. "Ian and I will take it in turns to dig."
I was no longer nervous, but still felt like a grave robber, standing under a pine tree with my torch, watching young Ian and Jamie take their turns in the deepening pit, their naked backs gleaming with sweat in the torchlight.
"Medical students used to pay men to steal fresh bodies from churchyards," I said, handing my soiled kerchief to Jamie as he hauled himself out of the hole, grunting with effort. "That was the only way they could practice dissection."
"Did they?" Jamie said.
He wiped the sweat from his face and gave me a quick, wry glance.
"Or do they?"
Luckily, it was too dark for Ian to notice my flush, despite the torchlight. It wasn't the first slip I had made, nor was it likely to be the last. But most such inadvertences resulted in nothing more than a quizzical glance, were they noticed at all. The truth simply wasn't a possibility that would occur to anyone.
"I imagine they do it now," I admitted.
I shivered slightly at the thought of confronting a freshly exhumed and unpreserved body, still smeared with the dirt of its desecrated grave. Cadavers embalmed and laid on a stainless steel surface were not particularly pleasant either. But the formality of their presentation served to keep the corruptive realities of death at some small distance. I exhaled strongly through my nose, trying to rid myself of odours imagined and remembered. When I breathed in, my nostrils were filled with the smell of damp earth and hot pitch from my pine torch, and the fainter, cooler echo of live scent from the pines overhead.
"They take paupers and criminals from the prisons, too?"
Young Ian, who had evidently heard the exchange, if not understood it, took the opportunity to stop for a moment, wiping his brow as he leaned on the shovel.
"Da told me about one time he was arrested, when they took him to Edinburgh and kept him in the toll booth. He was in a cell with 3 other men, and one of them, a fellow with a consumption, who coughed something dreadful, keeping the rest awake all night and all day. Then one night the coughing stopped, and they kent he was dead. But Da said they were so tired they couldn't do more than say a Pater Noster for his soul and fell asleep."
The boy paused and rubbed an itching nose.
"Da said he woke quite sudden, with someone clutching his legs and another someone taking him by the arms, lifting him up. He kicked and cried out, and the one who had his arms screeched and dropped him, so that he cracked his head on the stones. He sat up rubbing his pate and found himself staring at a doctor from the hospital and 2 fellows he'd brought along to carry away the corpse to the dissecting room."
Ian grinned broadly at the recollection, wiping his sweat-soaked hair out of his face.
"Da said he wasn't sure who was most horrified, him or the fellows who'd got the wrong body. He did say as the doctor seemed regretful, though. Said Da would have made a more interesting specimen, what with his leg stump and all."
Jamie laughed, stretching his arms to ease his shoulders. With face and torso streaked with red dirt, and his hair bound back with a kerchief round his forehead, he looked as reputable as any grave robber.
"Aye, I mind that story," he said.
"Ian did say after that, as all doctors were ghouls, I wouldn't have a thing to do with them."
He grinned at me. I had been a doctor, a surgeon, in my own time, but here I'd passed as nothing more than a wise woman, skilled in the use of herbs.
"Fortunately, I'm no afraid of wee ghoulies myself," he said,
and leaned down to kiss me briefly. His lips were warm, tasting of ale. I could see droplets of sweat caught in the curly hairs of his chest, and his nipples dark buds in the dim light. A tremor that had nothing to do either with cold or with the eeriness of our surroundings ran down my spine. He saw it, and his eyes met mine. He took a deep breath, and all at once I was conscious of the close fit of my bodice and the weight of my breasts in the sweat-soaked fabric. Jamie shifted himself slightly, plucking to ease the fit of his breeches. "Damn," he said softly. He lowered his eyes and turned away, mouth barely touched by a rueful smile. I hadn't expected it, but I recognized it all right. A sudden surge of lust was a common, if peculiar, response to the presence of death. Soldiers feel it in the lull after battle. So do healers who deal in blood and struggle. Perhaps Ian had been more right than I thought about the ghoulishness of doctors. Jamie's hand touched my back, and I started, showering sparks from the blazing torch. He took it from me and nodded toward a nearby gravestone.
"Sit down, Sassenach," he said. "You shouldn't have been standing so long."
I had cracked the tibia of my left leg in the shipwreck, and while it had healed quickly, the leg still ached sometimes.
"I'm all right."
Still, I moved toward the stone, brushing against him as I passed. He radiated heat, but his naked flesh was cool to the touch, the sweat evaporating on his skin. I could smell him. I glanced at him and saw goosebumps rise on the fair flesh where I touched him. I swallowed, fighting back a sudden vision of tumbling in the dark to a fierce blind coupling amid crushed grass and raw earth. His hand lingered on my elbow as he helped me to a seat on the stone. Rollo was lying by its side, drops of saliva gleaming in the torchlight as he panted. The slanted yellow eyes narrowed at me.
"Don't even think about it," I said, narrowing my own eyes back at him. "Bite me and I'll cram my shoe down your throat so far you'll choke." "Woof," Rollo said, quite softly.
He laid his muzzle on his paws, but the hairy ears were pricked, turned to catch the slightest sound. The spade chunked softly into the earth at Ian's feet, and he straightened up, slicking sweat off his face with a palm swipe that left black smears along his jaw. He blew out a deep breath and glanced up at Jamie, miming exhaustion, tongue lolling from the corner of his mouth.
"Aye, I expect it's deep enough."
Jamie answered the wordless plea with a nod.
"I'll fetch Gavin along, then."
Fergus frowned uneasily, his features sharp in the torchlight.
"Will you not need help to carry the corpse?"
His reluctance was evident. Still, he had offered. Jamie gave him a faint, wry smile.
"I'll manage well enough," he said. "Gavin was a wee man. Still, ye might bring the torch to see by."
"I'll come too, uncle."
Young Ian scrambled hastily out of the pit, skinny shoulders gleaming with sweat.
"Just in case you need help," he added breathlessly.
"Afraid to be left in the dark?"
Fergus asked sarcastically. I thought that the surroundings must be making him uneasy. Though he occasionally teased Ian, whom he regarded as a younger brother, he was seldom cruel about it.
I am," Ian said simply. "Aren't you?"
Fergus opened his mouth, brows arched skyward, then chatted again, and turned without a word toward the black opening of the lich gate, whence Jamie had disappeared.
"Do you not think this is a terrible place, auntie?"
Ian murmured uneasily at my elbow, sticking close as we made our way through the looming stones, following the flicker of Fergus's torch.
"I keep thinking of that story Uncle Jamie told, and thinking
No, Gavin's dead.
Maybe the cold thing.
I mean, do you think would it maybe come for him? There was an audible swallow punctuating this question, and I felt an icy finger touch me just at the base of my spine. No, I said, a little too loudly. I grabbed Ian's arm, less for support than for the reassurance of his solidity. Certainly not. His skin was clammy with evaporating sweat, but the skinny muscularity of the arm under my hand was comforting. His half-visible presence reminded me faintly of Jamie. He was nearly as tall as his uncle, and very nearly as strong, though still lean and gangling with adolescence. We emerged with gratitude into the little pool of light thrown by Fergus's torch. The flickering light shone through the wagon wheels, throwing shadows that lay like spiderwebs in the dust. It was as hot in the road as it was in the churchyard, but the air seemed somehow freer, easier to breathe, out from under the suffocating trees. Rather to my surprise, Duncan was still awake, perched drooping on the wagon seat like a sleepy owl, shoulders hunched about his ears. He was crooning under his breath, but stopped when he saw us. The long wait seemed to have sobered him a bit. He got down from the seat steadily enough, and came round to the rear of the wagon to help Jamie. I smothered a yawn. I would be glad to be done with this melancholy duty, and on our way to rest, even if the only bed to look forward to was one of piled leaves.
Ifrin and joy, er viach coir. Sacre vierge!
My head snapped up. Everyone was shouting, and the horses, startled, were neighing and jerking frantically against their hobbles, making the wagon hop and lurch like a drunken beetle.
Ugh!
Rollo said next to me.
Jesus!
Said Ian, goggling at the wagon.
Jesus Christ!
I swung in the direction he was looking and screamed. A pale figure loomed out of the wagon bed, swaying with the wagon's jerking. I had no time to see more before all hell broke loose. Rollo bunched his hindquarters and launched himself through the dark with a roar to the accompaniment of shouts from Jamie and Ian and a terrible scream from the ghost. Behind me I could hear the sound of French cursing as Fergus ran back into the churchyard, stumbling and crashing over tombstones in the dark. Jamie had dropped the torch. It flickered and hissed on the dusty road, threatening to go out. I fell to my knees and grabbed it, blowing on it, desperate to keep it alight. The chorus of shouts and growling grew to a crescendo, and I rose up, torch in hand, to find Ian struggling with Rollo, trying to keep him away from the dim figures wrestling together in a cloud of dust.
Arrêtez, espèce de cochon!
Fergus galloped out of the dark, brandishing the spade he'd gone to fetch. Finding his injunction disregarded, he stepped forward and brought it down one-handed on the intruder's head with a dull clong. Then he swung toward Ian and Rollo.
You be quiet too,
Fergus said to the dog, threatening him with a shovel.
Shut up this minute, foul beast, or I'll brain you.
Rollo snarled with a show of impressive teeth that I interpreted roughly to mean you and who else, but was prevented from mayhem by Ian, who wrapped his arm about the dog's throat and choked off any further remarks.
Where did he come from?
Ian asked in amazement. He craned his neck, trying to get a look at the fallen figure without letting go of Rollo.
From hell, Fergus said briefly, and I invite him to go back there at once.
He was trembling with shock and exertion. The light gleamed dully from his hook as he brushed a thick lock of black hair out of his eyes.
Not from hell. From the gallows. D'ye not know him?
Jamie rose slowly to his feet, dusting his breeches. He was breathing heavily and smeared with dirt, but seemed unhurt. He picked up his fallen kerchief and glanced about, wiping his face.
"Where's Duncan?"
"Here, MacDhu,"
said a gruff voice from the front of the wagon.
"The beasts weren't liking Gavin much to start with, and they're proper upset to think he was a resurrecting."
"Not," he added fairly, "but what I was a wee bit startled myself."
He eyed the figure on the ground with disfavour and patted one skittish horse firmly on the neck.
"Ah, it's no but a silly bugger, alloy. Hush your noise now, aye?
I had handed Ian the torch and knelt to inspect the damage to our visitor. This seemed to be slight. The man was already stirring. Jamie was right. It was the man who had escaped hanging earlier in the day. He was young, about 30, muscular and powerfully built, his fair hair matted with sweat and stiff with filth. He reeked of prison and the musky, sharp smell of prolonged fear. Little wonder. I got a hand under his arm and helped him to sit up. He grunted and put his hand to his head, squinting in the torchlight. "Are you all right?" I asked.
"Thanking you kindly, ma'am. I will have been better."
He had a faint accent and a soft, deep voice. Rollo, upper lip lifted just enough to show a menacing eye tooth, shoved his nose into the visitor's armpit, sniffed, then jerked back his head and sneezed explosively. A small tremor of laughter ran round the circle, and the tension relaxed momentarily.
"How long have you been in the wagon?" Duncan demanded.
"Since mid-afternoon."
The man rose awkwardly on his knees, swaying a bit from the effects of the blow. He touched his head again and winced.
"Oh, Jesus. I crawled in there just after the Frenchie loaded up poor old Gavin."
"Where were you before that?" Ian asked.
"Hiding under the gallows cart. It was the only place I thought they wouldn't be looking."
He rose laboriously to his feet, closed his eyes to get his balance, then opened them. They were a pale green in the torchlight, the colour of shallow seas. I saw them flick from face to face, then settle on Jamie. The man bowed, careful of his head.
"Stephen Bonnet, your servant, sir."
He made no move to extend a hand in greeting, nor did Jamie.
"Mr. Bonnet?"
Jamie nodded back, face carefully blank. I didn't know quite how he contrived to look commanding, wearing nothing but a pair of damp and dirt-stained breeks, but he managed it. He looked the visitor over, taking in every detail of his appearance. Bonnet was what country people called well set up, with a tall, powerful frame and a barrel chest, his features heavy-boned but coarsely handsome. A few inches shorter than Jamie, he stood easy, balanced on the balls of his feet, fists half-closed in readiness. No stranger to a fight, judging by the slight crookedness of his nose and a small scar by the corner of his mouth. The small imperfections did nothing to mar the overall impression of animal magnetism. He was the sort of man who attracted women easily. "Some women," I amended, as he cast a speculative glance at me.
"For what crime were you condemned, Mr. Bonnet?" Jamie asked.
He himself stood easy, but with a look of watchfulness that reminded me forcibly of Bonnet himself. It was the ears-back look male dogs give each other before deciding whether to fight.
"Smuggling," Bonnet said.
Jamie didn't reply, but tilted his head slightly. One brow rose in inquiry.
"And piracy?"
A muscle twitched near Bonnet's mouth, a poor attempt at a smile, or an involuntary quiver of fear.
"And will you have killed anyone in the commission of your crimes, Mr. Bonnet?"
Jamie's face was blank, save for the watchful eyes.
"Think twice," his eyes said plainly, "or maybe three times." "None that were not trying to kill me first," Bonnet replied.
The words were easy, the tone almost flippant, but belied by the hand that closed tight into a fist by his side. It dawned on me that Bonnet must feel he was facing judge and jury as surely as he had faced them once before. He had no way of knowing that we were nearly as reluctant to go near the garrison soldiers as he was. Jamie looked at Bonnet for a long moment, peering closely at him in the flickering torchlight, then nodded and took a half-step back.
"Go then," he said quietly. "We'll not hinder you."
Bonnet took an audible breath. I could see the big frame relax, shoulders slumping under the cheap linen shirt.
"Thank you," he said.
He wiped a hand across his face and took another deep breath. The green eyes darted from me to Fergus to Duncan.
"But will you help me, maybe?"
Duncan, who had relaxed at Jamie's words, gave a grunt of surprise.
Help you? A thief?
Bonnet's head swiveled in Duncan's direction. The iron collar was a dark line about his neck, giving the eerie impression that his severed head floated several inches above his shoulders.
Help me, he repeated. There will be soldiers on the roads tonight, hunting me.
He gestured toward the wagon.
You could take me safely past them, if you will.
He turned back to Jamie and straightened his back, shoulders stiff.
I'm begging for your help, sir, in the name of Gavin Hayes, who was my friend as well as yours, and a thief, as I am.
The men studied him in silence for a moment, digesting this. Fergus glanced inquiringly at Jamie. The decision was his. But Jamie, after a long considering look at Bonnet, turned to Duncan.
What say you, Duncan?
Duncan gave Bonnet the same kind of look that Jamie himself had used, and finally nodded.
For Gavin's sake, he said,
and turned away toward the lich gate.
All right, then, Jamie said.
He sighed and pushed a loose lock of hair behind his ear.
Help us to bury Gavin, he said to our new guest, and then we'll go.
An hour later, Gavin's grave was a blank rectangle of fresh-turned earth, stark among the grey hues of the surrounding grass.
He must have his name to mark him by, Jamie said.
Painstakingly, he scratched the letters of Gavin's name and his dates upon a piece of smooth beech stone, using the point of his knife. I rubbed soot from the torch into the incised letters, making a crude but readable grave marker, and Ian set this solidly into a small cairn of gathered pebbles. Atop the tiny monument, Jamie gently set the stub of candle that he had taken from the tavern. Everyone stood awkwardly about the grave for a moment, not knowing how to take farewell. Jamie and Duncan stood close together, looking down. They would have taken final leave of many such comrades since Culloden, if often with less ceremony. Finally, Jamie nodded to Fergus, who took a dry pine twig, and lighting it from my torch, bent and touched it to the candle's wick.
Requiem aeternam dona ei. Et lux perpetua luceat ei,
Jamie said quietly.
Eternal rest grant unto him, O God, and let perpetual light shine upon him,
young Ian echoed it softly, his face solemn in the torchlight. Without a word, we turned and left the churchyard. Behind us, the candle burned without a flicker in the still, heavy air, like the sanctuary lamp in an empty church. The moon was high in the sky by the time we reached the military checkpoint outside the city walls. It was only a half-moon, but shed enough light for us to see the trampled dirt track of the wagon road that ran before us, wide enough for two wagons to travel abreast. We had encountered several such points on the road between Savannah and Charleston, mostly manned by bored soldiers who waved us through without bothering to check the passes we had obtained in Georgia. The checkpoints were mostly concerned with the interception of smuggled goods, and with the capture of the odd bondservant or slave escaped from his master. Even filthy and unkempt, we passed notice for the most part. Few travellers were in better case. Fergus and Duncan couldn't be indentured men, maimed as they were, and Jamie's presence transcended his clothes. Shabby coat or not, no man would take him for a servant. Tonight was different, though. There were 8 soldiers at the checkpoint, not the usual 2, and all were armed and alert. Musket barrels flashed in the moonlight as the shout of, "Halt! Your name and your business!" came from the dark. A lantern was hoisted up 6 inches from my face, blinding me for a moment.
"James Freezer, bound for Wilmington with my family and servants."
Jamie's voice was calm, and his hands were steady as he handed me the reins before reaching for the passes in his coat. I kept my head down, trying to look tired and indifferent. I was tired, all right. I could have lain down in the road and slept, but far from indifferent.
What did they do to you for aiding the escape of a fugitive from the gallows? I wondered. A single drop of sweat snaked its way down the back of my neck.
Have you seen anyone along the road as you passed, sir?
The sir came a little reluctantly. The dilapidation of Jamie's coat and my gown were obvious in the pool of yellow lantern light.
A carriage that passed us from the town? I suppose you will have seen that yourselves, Jamie answered.
The sergeant replied with a grunt, checking the passes carefully, then squinting into the dark to count and see that the attendant bodies matched.
What goods do you carry?
He handed back the passes, motioning to one of his subordinates to search the wagon. I twitched the reins inadvertently, and the horses snorted and shook their heads. Jamie's foot nudged mine, but he didn't look at me.
Small household goods, he answered, still calm. A half of venison and a bag of salt for provision. And a body.
The soldier, who had been reaching for the wagon covering, stopped abruptly. The sergeant looked up sharply.
A what?
Jamie took the reins from me and wrapped them casually about his wrist. From the corner of my eye I saw Duncan edge toward the darkness of the wood. Fergus, with his pickpocket skill, had already faded from view.
The corpse of the man who was hanged this afternoon. He was known to me. I asked permission of Colonel Franklin to take him to his kinsman in the north. That is why we travel by night, he added delicately. Oh, I see.
The sergeant motioned a lantern-bearer closer. He gave Jamie a long, thoughtful look, eyes narrowed, and nodded.
I remember you, he said. You called out to him at the last. A friend, was he? I knew him once, some years ago, he added.
The sergeant nodded to his subordinate, not taking his eyes off Jamie.
Have a look, Griswold.
Griswold, who was perhaps 14, betrayed a notable lack of enthusiasm for the order, but dutifully lifted the canvas cover and raised his lantern to peer into the wagon bed. With an effort, I kept myself from turning to look. The near horse snorted and tossed its head. If we did have to bolt, it would take several seconds for the horses to get the wagon moving. I heard Ian shift behind me, getting his hand on the club of hickory wood stowed behind the seat.
"Yes, sir, it's a body," Griswold reported. "In a shroud."
He dropped the canvas with an air of relief and exhaled strongly through his nostrils.
"Fix your bayonet and give it a jab,"
the sergeant said, eyes still on Jamie. I must have made a small noise, for the sergeant's glance shifted to me.
"You'll soil my wagon," Jamie objected. "The man's fair ripe after a day in the sun, eh?"
The sergeant snorted impatiently.
"Jab it in the leg, then. Get on, Griswold."
With a marked air of reluctance, Griswold affixed his bayonet and, standing on tiptoe, began to poke gingerly about in the wagon bed. Behind me, Ian had begun to whistle softly, a Gaelic tune whose title translated to "In the Morn We Die," which I thought very tasteless of him.
"No, sir, he's dead all right."
Griswold dropped back on his heels, sounding relieved.
"I poked right hard, but not a twitch." "All right, then."
Dismissing the young soldier with a jerk of his hand, the sergeant nodded to Jamie.
"Drive on, then, Mr. Fraser. But I'd advise you to choose your friends more carefully in the future."
I saw Jamie's knuckles whiten on the reins, but he only drew himself up straight and settled his hat more firmly on his head. He clicked his tongue, and the horses set off sharply, leaving puffs of pale dust floating in the lantern light. The darkness seemed engulfing after the light. Despite the moon, I could see almost nothing. The night enfolded us. I felt the relief of a hunted animal that finds safe refuge, and in spite of the oppressive heat, I breathed more freely. We covered a distance of nearly a quarter mile before anyone spoke.
"Are you wounded, Mr. Bonnet?"
Ian spoke in a loud whisper, just audible over the rattle of the wagon.
"Yes. He's pinked me in the thigh, damn the puppy."
Bonnet's voice was low but calm.
"Thank Christ he left off before the blood soaked through the shroud. Dead men don't bleed."
"Are you hurt badly?" Shall I come back and have a look at it? I twisted around. Bonnet had pushed back the canvas cover and was sitting up, a vague pale shape in the darkness.
No, I thank you, ma'am. I've my stocking wound round it. It will serve well enough, I expect.
My night vision was returning. I could see the gleam of fair hair as he bent his head to his task.
Can you walk, do you think?
Jamie slowed the horses to a walk and twisted round to inspect our guest. While his tone was not inhospitable, it was clear that he would prefer to be rid of our dangerous cargo as soon as possible.
Not easily, no. I'm not sorry, sir.
Bonnet was aware of Jamie's eagerness to be rid of him, too. With some difficulty, he hoisted himself up in the wagon bed, rising onto his good knee behind the seat. His lower half was invisible in darkness, but I could smell the blood on him, a sharper scent than the lingering faint reek of Gavin's shroud.
A suggestion, Mr. Fraser. In 3 miles we'll come to the Ferry Trail Road. A mile past the crossroads, another road leads toward the coast. It's little more than a pair of ruts, but passable. That will take us to the edge of a creek with an outlet to the sea. Some associates of mine will be putting in to anchor there within the week. If you would grant me some small stock of provisions, I can await them in reasonable safety, and you can be on your way, free of the taint of my company.
Associates? You mean pirates?
Ian's voice held a certain amount of wariness. Having been abducted from Scotland by pirates, he invested such persons with none of the romanticism normal to a 15-year-old.
That would depend upon your perspective, lad.
Bonnet sounded amused.
Certainly the governors of the Carolinas would call them so. The merchants of Wilmington and Charleston perhaps regard them otherwise.
Jamie gave a brief snort.
Smugglers, eh? And what might these associates of yours be dealing in, then? Whatever will fetch a price to make it worth the risk of carrying.
The amusement had not left Bonnet's voice, but was now tinged with cynicism.
Will you be wanting some reward for your assistance? That can be managed. I do not.
Jamie's voice was cold.
I saved you for Gavin his sake, and for my own. I wouldna seek reward for such a service. I meant no offence to you, sir.
Bonnet's head inclined slightly toward us.
None taken, Jamie answered shortly.
He shook out the reins and wrapped them afresh, changing hands. Conversation lapsed after this small clash, though Bonnet continued to ride, kneeling behind us, peering over my shoulder at the dark road ahead. There were no more soldiers, though. Nothing moved, not even a breath of wind in the leaves. Nothing disturbed the silence of the summer night save the occasional thin zeek of a passing nightbird or the hooting of an owl. The soft rhythmic thump of the horse's hooves in the dust and the squeak and rattle of the wagon began to lull me to sleep. I tried to keep upright, watching the black shadows of the trees along the road, but found myself gradually inclining toward Jamie, my eyes falling shut despite my best efforts. Jamie transferred the reins to his left hand, and putting his right arm around me, drew me down to rest against his shoulder. As always, I felt safe when I touched him. I went limp, cheek pressed against the dusty serge of his coat, and fell at once into that uneasy doze that is the consequence of a combination of utter exhaustion and the inability to lie down. I opened my eyes once to see the tall, lean figure of Duncan Innes pacing alongside the wagon with his tireless hillman's stride, head bowed as though in deep thought. Then I closed them again and drifted into a doze in which memories of the day mingled with inchoate fragments of dreams. I dreamt of a giant skunk sleeping under a tavern's table, waking to join in a chorus of the Star-Spangled Banner, and then of a swinging corpse that raised its lolling head and grinned with empty eyes. I came awake to find Jamie gently shaking me.
"You'd best crawl into the back and lie down, Sassenach," he said. You're crickling in your sleep. He'll be slipping into the road next thing.
Blearily assenting, I clambered awkwardly over the seat back, changing places with Bonnet, and found a place in the wagon bed next to the slumbering form of young Ian. It smelt musty and worse in the wagon bed. Ian had his head pillowed on a packet of roughly butchered venison wrapped in the untanned skin of the deer. Rollo had done somewhat better, his hairy muzzle resting comfortably on Ian's stomach. For myself, I took the leathern bag of salt. The smooth leather was hard under my cheek, but odourless. The jolting boards of the wagon bed couldn't by any stretch of the imagination be called comfortable, but the relief of being able to stretch out at full length was so overwhelming that I scarcely noticed the bumps and jolts. I rolled onto my back and looked up into the hazy immensity of the southern sky, studded thick with blazing stars. Lumen Christi, I thought, and comforted by the thought of Gavin Hayes finding his way safe home by the lights of heaven, fell once more fast asleep. I couldn't tell how long I slept, wrapped in a drugged blanket of heat and exhaustion. I woke when the pace of the wagon changed, swimming toward the surface of consciousness drenched with sweat. Bonnet and Jamie were talking in the low, easy tones of men who had found their way past the early awkwardness of first acquaintance.
"You said that you saved me for Gavin Hayes' sake, and for your own," Bonnet was saying.
His voice was soft, barely audible above the rumble of the wheels.
"What did you mean by that, sir, and you'll pardon my asking?"
Jamie didn't answer at once. I nearly fell asleep again before he spoke, but at last his answer came, floating disembodied in the warm, dark air.
"You will not have slept much last night, I think, knowing what was to come to you with the day."
There was a low laugh from Bonnet, not entirely amused.
"Too right," he said. "I doubt I shall forget it in a hurry." "Nor will I," Jamie said something soft in Gaelic to the horses, and they slowed in response. "I once lived through such a night, knowing I would hang come morning. And yet I lived, through the grace of one who risked much to save me." "I see,"
Bonnet said softly.
"So you're an Askana Ageli, are you?" "Aye? What'll that be?"
There was a sound of scraping and brushing leaves against the side of the wagon, and the spicy sap scent of the trees grew suddenly stronger. Something light touched my face, leaves falling from above. The horses slowed, and the rhythm of the wagon changed markedly, the wheels finding an uneven surface. We had turned into the small road that led to Bonnet's Creek.
"Askana Ageli is a term that the Red Savages employ, the Cherokee of the mountains. I heard it from one I had as a guide one time. It means half-ghost, one who should have died by right but yet remains on the earth. A woman who survives a mortal illness. A man fallen into his enemy's hands who escapes.
They say an Askana Ageli has one foot on the earth and the other in the spirit world. He can talk to the spirits and see the Nunahi, the little people."
"Little people? Will that be like the fairies?"
Jamie sounded surprised.
"Something of the kind."
Bonnet shifted his weight and the seat creaked as he stretched.
"The Indians do say that the Nunahi live inside the rocks of the mountains and come out to help their people in time of war or other evil."
"Is that so?"
"It'll be something like the tales they tell in the Highlands of Scotland, then. Of the old folk."
"Indeed."
Bonnet sounded amused.
"Well, from what I have heard of the Scotch Highlanders, there is little to choose between them and the red men for barbarous conduct."
"Nonsense," said Jamie, sounding not the least offended.
"The red savages eat the hearts of their enemies, or so I've heard. I prefer a good dish of oatmeal porridge myself."
Bonnet made a noise, hastily stifled.
"You're a Highlander? Well, I will say that for a barbarian I found you passing civil, sir," he assured Jamie,
the laughter quivering in his voice.
"'I'm exceedingly obliged for your kind opinion, sir,'
Jamie replied with equal politeness. Their voices faded into the rhythm